in your every thought and memory. One of the Cyclonese dragons that had separated from the rest of the formation slammed into his neck. The vice on her mind sprang open. She fell against Onren, shuddering. Tane! The flock tore at Narumo. The imperial dragon, who was almost as large as the monster, forced a path through the swarm, let out a mighty roar, and scourged the nameless one with her claws. Gold sparks flew, and for the first time, gouges appeared in their age-old armor. The nameless one twisted his head, teeth bared, but the imperial dragon was already out of reach. Onren punched the air. "For Psyche!" she cried out. Other riders echoed her. Tane shouted it until her throat was raw. The sea general blew through his war conch, summoning the dragons for a second foray. This time, the flock they faced was even larger, a wall of wings. Fire breathers everywhere were abandoning the clashes with the ships and flying to defend their master. Their ranks closed around the nameless one, who was moving ever closer to the fleet. "We can't get through that," Onren grasped the saddle. "Narumo, take us to the front." He growled low and drew up alongside the elders. Tane tensed as the sea general turned his face towards them. Onren snapped open a fan and signalled for him to cease the charge. The sea general signed with a fan in return. He wanted them to approach from above. Other riders passed the message along. Upward they flew, towards the moon. When they dived, in perfect unison, Tane narrowed her eyes. The wind tore back her hair. She reached for Ascalon and drew it from the sheath. This time, she would strike him. One moment, the fire breathers rose to meet them. The next, all Tane could see was darkness. Narumo let out a roar. A blue glow vented between his scales before lightning splintered from his mouth. Every hair on Tane stood on end. As Narumo skewered the amphipter on his horns, another bolt flashed out of the turmoil. It whipped past Onren, glanced off her armor, and caught Tane across the bare skin of her arm. She felt her heart stop. The lightning hit a wyvern, but not before it set her clothes on fire. Onren screamed her name just before Tane was thrust from Dragonback into the chaos of the sky. The wind smothered her shirt, but not the white-hot flame beneath her skin. For a moment, she felt weightless. She could hear nothing, see nothing. When she became aware again, the fire breathers were high above her, the black sea rushing up below. Ascalon was wrenched from her hand. One flash of silver, and it vanished. She had failed. The sword was gone. Nothing but death awaited them at the end of this day. Hope was lost, but her body refused to give up the fight. Some long-buried instinct made her heed her training. All students of the Houses of Learning had been taught how to raise their chances of survival if they should ever fall from Dragonback. She faced the abyss and opened her arms, as if to embrace it. Then, a banner of misty green rushed beneath her. She was caught in the coil of a tail. "I have you, little sister." Nyarmathan lifted Tane onto her back. "Hold on." Her fingers splayed over wet scales.
"Nyarmathan!"
Tane gasped. Livid red branches had spread from her shoulder, down her right arm and across her neckline.
"Nyarmathan," she said, panting. "I lost Ascalon."
"No," Nyarmathan said. "This is not over. It fell to the deck of the Dancing Pearl."
Tane looked down at the ships. It seemed impossible that the sword had avoided the endless black water. Another ship fractured into pieces as its black powder combusted. Bleeding, his wing injured, Fyodel threw back his head and let out a long sound that stemmed from deep within. Even Tane knew what it was. A rallying cry. The herd above their heads was thrown into disarray. As she watched, half of the fire breathers dropped away from the nameless one to Fyodel.
"Now!"
Tane shouted.
"Now, Nyarmathan!"
Her dragon did not hesitate. She flew towards the enemy.
"Aim for his chest!"
Tane unsheathed the sword at her side. Rain lashed.
"We have to break through his scales!"
Nyarmathan bared her teeth. She rammed through what remained of the vanguard. The other dragons were calling to her, but she paid them no heed. As fire roared to meet them, she swept over the nameless one and wrapped herself around his body so her head was beneath his, out of the reach of his teeth and flame. Tane heard her scales begin to sizzle.
"Go, Tane,"
she forced out. Forgetting her fear, Tane leaped from Dragonback and grabbed onto a scale.
The heat burned through her gauntlets, but she kept climbing up the Nameless One, stretching up to each plate of his armor, using their razor-sharp edges as handholds, counting down from the top of his throat. When she reached the 20th scale, she saw the imperfection, the place where it had never fitted smoothly back over the scar beneath. Holding on with one hand, she jammed the blade of her sword beneath the scale, planted her boots on the one below, and pulled on the haft with all her might. The Nameless One opened its jaws and let out an inferno, but though the fire soaked her in sweat and made it hard to breathe, Tane kept craning. Screaming with the effort, she threw all her weight behind the pull. The blade of her sword snapped. She dropped 10 feet before she flung out a hand and caught herself on another scale. Her arms were trembling. She was going to slip. Then, with a war cry that rang in her bones, Nyarlathotep reared. The haft of the sword caught between two of her teeth. With one jerk of her head, she ripped the scale free. Steam vented from the flesh of the Nameless One. Tane threw out an arm to stop it scalding her and fell from his armor. Her fingers caught in a riverweed mane. She hauled herself back onto Nyarlathotep. At once, her dragon uncoiled herself, scales burnt dry, and plunged towards the ocean. Tane choked on the stench of hot metal. The Nameless One came after them, jaws gaping to show the spark in his throat. Nyarlathotep keened as razor teeth closed on her tail. The sound screamed through Tane. She flicked her knife into her hand, twisted at the waist, and hurled it into the depths of a black eye. His jaws unlocked, but not before flesh and scale tore asunder. Nyarlathotep tumbled away from him, towards the abyss, blood spraying from her.
Nyarlathotep!
Tane choked on her name.
Nyarlathotep!
The rain turned silver.
"Find the sword," was all her dragon said. Her voice was fading. "This must end here. It must be now."
The soldier stabbed Fa'ird with his partisan, almost catching her cheek. His face was clammy, he had pissed himself, and he was shaking so hard his jaw rattled.
"Stop fighting, you witless fool," Fa'ird shouted at him. "Drop your weapon or you give me no choice."
He wore a mail coat and a scaled helmet. His eyes were bloodshot with exhaustion, but he was in the grip of something beyond reason. When he swung for Fa'ird again, the blow pendulous, she ducked beneath his arm and drew her sword upward, opening him from belly to shoulder. The man had come from the Draconic Navy. Its soldiers fought as if possessed, and perhaps they were, possessed by fear of what would happen to their families in Cascaro if they lost this fight. The Nameless One circled high above the ships. Fa'ird watched as he thrashed and a ribbon of pale green fell away from him. The sound of the draconic tongue echoed across the waves.
"The sword!" Fa'ird bellowed. "Find the sword!"
Half the Askarli soldiers scrambled to obey, while others took to the sea. Blood was spreading through the water, along with the wax that had protected the ships. A wyvern winged overhead and set fire to a trail of debris. Howls rose as soldiers and seafarers were broiled alive. Fa'ird cupped a bloody hand over the waning jewel. There was a hum inside it, a tiny heartbeat. Find the sword. The jewel was calling to itself, seeking out the stars. She stepped over another body towards the prow. The hum faded. When she backtracked to the stern, it grew stronger. The Dancing Pearl was the nearest ship, straight ahead of her, still afloat. She dived. Her body sliced deep into the water. A flare of light lit her way as more gunpowder ignited.
"Daughter of Zala."
She knew the voice was in her head. It was too clear, too soft, as if the speaker was close enough for her to feel his breath. But under the water, it seemed as if it stemmed from the abyss itself. The voice of the Nameless One.
"I know your name, Eadaz Uknara. My servants have whispered it in voices filled with dread. They speak of a root of the orange tree, a root that can stretch far into the world and still burn golden as the sun."
"I am the handmaiden of Clearlind, Serpent." Somehow she knew how to speak to him.
"This night I will complete her work. Without me you will have nothing to unite you. You will fall to wars of wealth and religion. You will make enemies of each other, as you always have, and you will end yourselves."
Fa'ird swam. The white jewel rang against her skin.
"You need not give your life."
Her head broke the surface, and she kept swimming.
Another fire burns in your heart. Become my handmaiden instead, and I will spare Sabran Berithnit. If you do not do this, the voice said, I will break her.
You will have to break me first, and I have proven difficult to break. She climbed onto the ship and rose.
So be it.
And so the Nameless One, the blight upon the nations, plunged towards the ship. Every fire in the abyss went out. All Eerd could hear were cries of fear as death came as a shadow from above. Only starlight pierced the darkness, but in that light Ascalon shone. She ran across the Dancing Pearl. Her world darkened until there was only the beat of her heart and the blade. She willed the Mother to give her the strength that had filled her on that day in Lassia. Unearthly metal, alive to her touch, the Nameless One opened his jaws, and a white sun rose inside his mouth. Eerd saw the place where his armor had been torn away. She lifted the sword that Caliba had made, that Clearlind had wielded, that had lived in song for 1,000 years. She buried it to the hilt in flesh. Ascalon glowed until it blinded her. She had a moment to see the skin of her hands simmering with heat, a moment, an age, something between, before the sword was wrenched from them. She was thrown high across the deck, over the gunwale, into the sea. Scale crashed through the Dancing Pearl, carving it fesswise. The strength left her as quickly as it had come. She had driven the blade into his heart, as the Mother had not, but it was not enough. He must be chained to the abyss to die, and she carried a key. The jewel drifted in front of her. The star inside it lit the dark. How she longed to sleep for eternity. Another light flickered in the shadows, lightning glowing in a vast pair of eyes. Tanne and her dragon. A hand reached through the water and Eerd grasped it. They rose from the ocean, towards the stars. Tanne held the blue jewel in one hand. The Nameless One thrashed in the abyss, head thrown back, fire spraying from his mouth like lava from the mantle of the earth, with Ascalon still buried in his breast. Tanne locked her right hand over Eerd's and pushed her fingers between her knuckles, so they both held the waning jewel. It pressed against the dying beat of her heart. "Together," Tanne whispered, "for Noporo, for Cleolind." Slowly, Eerd reached up with her other hand, and their fingers interlocked around the rising jewel. Her thoughts waxed faint with every breath, but her blood knew what to do. It was instinct, deep-rooted and ancient as the tree. The ocean rose to their command. They played this final game by turns, never breaking their hold on each other. They spun him a cocoon, two seamsters weaving with the waves. Steam filled the air as they knitted the Nameless One into the sea, and the darkness quenched the hot coal of his heart. He looked up at Eerd one last time, and she looked into him. A flash of light blinded her where Ascalon had torn him open. The beast of the mountain let out a scream before he disappeared. Eerd knew that she would hear that sound for as long as she drew breath. It would echo through her unquiet dreams, like a song across the desert. The dragons of the east dived after him to see him to his grave. The sea closed over all their heads, and the abyss was still. Chapter 72. West. In the foothills of the Spindles, the worm Helvisa was dead, brought down by a harpoon. All around her, the ground was strewn with earthly remains of human and worm. Fyodel had not stayed to defend his draconic territory. Instead, he had summoned his brother and sister to rout the combined armies of north and south and west. They had failed. As for Fyodel himself, he had taken wing as soon as the Nameless One had disappeared beneath the waves, and his followers had scattered once more. The sun was rising over Ascalon. Its light fell on the blood and the char, the fire and the bones. A Cycanese woman named Onren had brought Loth here on Dragonback so he could find Margaret. Standing on the wretched plain, he strained his gaze to Cascaro. Smoke rose from the once great city. No one had been able to tell him whether the Dommata Morosa had survived the night. What was known was that King Sagoso, murderer of queens, was dead. His wasted corpse hung from the gate of Neunda. Seeing it had caused his soldiers to desert. Loth prayed the princess lived. With all his soul, he prayed she was up there, ready to be crowned. The field hospital was a league from where the fight had begun. Several tents had been erected near a mountain stream, and the flags of all nations flew outside them. The wounded were crying in agony. Some had burns that went deep into their flesh. Others were so covered in blood they were unrecognizable. Loth spotted King Jantar of the Aesir among those who were gravely hurt, lying with his warriors, tended to from all sides. One woman, whose leg had been shattered, was biting down on a leather strap while the barber surgeon sawed it off below the knee. Healers brought in pails of water. He found Margaret in a tent for Innish casualties. Its flaps were open to let out the reek of vinegar. A blood-stained apron was tied over her skirts. She was kneeling beside Sir Tharion Lintley, who lay still and bruised on a pallet. A deep wound stretched from his jaw to his temple. It had been stitched with care, but he would be scarred for life. Margaret looked up at Loth. For a moment, she was blear-eyed, as if she had forgotten who he was. Loth! He crouched beside her. When she leaned into him, he enveloped her into his arms and rested his chin on the top of her head.
I think he'll be all right.
She smelled of smoke. It was a soldier, not a worm. His sister curled against his chest.
He is dead. Loth kissed her brow. It's over, Meg.
Her face was smeared with ash. Tears washed into her eyes, and she pressed a trembling hand to her mouth. Outside, a finger of light broached the horizon, pink as a wild rose. As a new spring dawn crested the spindles, they held each other close and watched it gild the sky. Chapter 73 West Brigstad, capital of the Free State of Mentendon, crown jewel of learning in the West. Years he had dreamed of returning to its streets. There were the tall and narrow houses, each with a bell gable. There were the sugared roofs. There was the crocketed spire of the Sanctuary of the Saint, towering from the heart of the city. Maclay's ruse sat in a heated coach, wrapped in a fur-lined cloak. During his convalescence at Ascalon Palace, High Princess Ermuna had written to request his presence at court. His knowledge of the East, she had told him in her letter, would help enrich the relationship between Mentendon and Psyche. He might even be called upon to help open negotiations for a new trade deal with the Empire of the Twelve Lakes. He wanted none of it. That court was haunted. If he walked there, all he would see were the ghosts of his past. Still, he had to show his face. One did not refuse a royal invitation, especially if one was intending not to be banished again. The coach trundled over the Sunbridge. Through the window, he looked out at the frozen River Bugen and the snow-capped spires of the city he had lost. He had crossed this bridge on foot when he had first come to court, having travelled from Rosington on a haywain. In those days, he had not been able to afford coaches. His mother had withheld his inheritance, pointing out, not erroneously, that it amounted to the cost of his degree. All he had possessed was a sharp tongue and the shirt on his back. It had been enough for Janart. His left arm now ended just below the elbow. Though it ached at times, the pain was easy to ignore. Death had kissed his cheek at the Dancing Pearl. The Innish physicians had assured him that now he was through the worst, what was left of the limb would heal. He had never trusted Innish physicians, pious quacks, the lot of them, but he supposed he had no choice but to believe them. It was Eadaz Uknada who had mortally wounded the Nameless One with the true sword. And then, as if that were not sufficient heroism for one night, she and Tane Madushi had finished him off with the jewels. It was the stuff of legend, a tale destined to be enshrined in song. And Neclaes had slept through the whole damned thing. The thought made a smile pull at the corner of his mouth. Janart would have laughed his guts out. Somewhere in the city, bells were ringing. Someone had been wed today. The coach passed the Free State Theatre. On some nights, Edvard had disguised himself as a minor lord and slipped out with Janart and Neclaes to watch an opera or concert or play. They had always gone drinking in the old quarter after, so Edvard could let go of his cares for a while. Neclaes closed his eyes, remembering the laughs of friends long dead. At least some of his friends had managed not to die. After the siege of Cascaro, a search party had been sent for Leia. As he had lain abed on the Dancing Pearl, racked with fever, he had remembered certain things about the cavern that had been their prison, namely the red veins that had snaked through its walls. They had found her in the Dreadmount. Close to death from thirst, she had been nursed back to health in a field hospital, and High Ruler Kagudo had taken her back to Nazeen on her own ship. After decades away, she was home, and had already written to invite him to visit her. He would go soon, when he had taken in enough of Mentendon to be certain it was there, to be sure that this was real. The coach stopped outside the gates of Brigstad Palace, an austere structure of dark sandstone, hiding an interior of white marble and gilt. A footman opened the door.
"Dr. Ruse," he said, "Her Royal Highness High Princess Amuna welcomes you back to Mentish Court."
Heat prickled in his eyes. He saw the stained glass dormer window of the highest room. "Not yet." The footman looked baffled.
"Doctor," he said, "Her Royal Highness expects you at noon."
"At noon, dear boy, noon is not now." He sat back. "Do take my belongings, but I shall go to the old quarter." Reluctantly, the footman gave the order. The coach trundled through the north of the city, past bookshops and museums and guild halls and bakehouses. Hungry for the sights, Nicolas leaned out on his elbow. Scents wafted from the open market, scents he had dreamed about so often in Orissima. Gingerbread and sugared quinces, pies to crack open with the flat of a knife, revealing the spiral of pear and cheese and cuts of hard-boiled egg inside, pancakes drizzled with sugar brandy, the apple tarts he had loved to eat on strolls along the river. On every corner, stalls sold pamphlets and tracts. The sight made Nicolas think of Perume and Izaru, his friends on the other side of the world. Perhaps, when and if the C-ban was lifted, they could walk these streets with him. The coach stopped outside a shabby-looking inn in a lane that branched off Bruna Square. The golden paint had flaked from its sign, but inside, the sun in splendour was just as he remembered it. There was something he had to do before he faced the court. He would seek the ghosts before they found him. It was traditional for the people of Mentendon to be laid to rest in their birthplaces. Only in rare cases was it permitted for them to be entombed elsewhere. Janot had been one of those rare cases. Custom dictated that he should be buried in Zeodur, but Edvard, torn by grief, had given his dearest friend the honour of a tomb in the Silver Cemetery, where members of the House of Lievelin were interred. Not long after, Edvard had caught the sweat and joined him there, along with his infant daughter. The cemetery was a short walk from the old quarter. Snow lay thick and untouched over its grounds. Nicolas had never visited the mausoleum. Instead, he had fled to Innis, racked with denial. Not believing in an afterlife, he had never seen the point of talking at a slab of stone. It was icy cold in the mausoleum. An effigy, sculpted from alabaster, lay upon the tomb. As he approached it, Nicolas breathed in deeply. Whoever had captured his likeness had known Janot well when he was in his early 40s. On the shield of the statue, representing the protection of the saint in death, was an inscription. "Janot ut Zeodur, seek not the midnight sun on earth, but look for it within." Nicolas spread his hand over the words. "Your bones lie behind me. Nothing lies ahead. You are dead, and I an old man," he murmured. "I resented you for such a long time, Janot. I had been comfortable in the belief that I would die before you did. Perhaps I even tried to ensure it. I hated you, hated the memory of you, for leaving first, leaving me." With a lump in his throat, he turned away. He sank to the floor, his back to the tomb, and clasped his hands between his knees. "I failed her, Jan." His voice grew almost too soft to hear. "I lost myself, and I lost sight of your grandchild. When the wolves encircled Trude, I was not there to beat them back. I thought..." Nicolas shook his head. "I thought of dying. When they brought me up from inside the Dancing Pearl, I watched the sea burning, light from darkness, fire and stars. I looked into the abyss and I almost let myself fall." A dry chuckle. "And then I stepped back, too heart-sore to live, too craven to die. But then, you sent me on that journey for a reason. The only way I could think to honour you was by continuing to live. You loved me, without condition. You saw the person I could be, and I will be that person, Jan. I will endure my midnight sun." He touched the stone face one more time, the lips that were so like they had been in life.
I will teach my heart to beat again.
It hurt to leave him in the dark. Still, leave he did. Those bones had long since let him go. Outside, the snow had eased a little, but a frigid chill remained. As he walked back through the cemetery, tears icy on his cheeks, a woman came through its wrought iron gates, wearing a cloak lined with sable. When she looked up, her lips parted and Nicolay's froze. He knew her well. Aladine Telden Utkantmarkt was standing in the cemetery.
Nicolay's, she whispered.
Aladine, he replied in disbelief. She was still a handsome woman in her August years. Her russet hair, as thick as ever, was streaked with white and gathered into a coiffure. The love knot ring was still on her hand, though not on the forefinger, where it ought to be. No ring had replaced it. They stared at each other. Aladine recovered first.
You truly are back.
She let out a sound, almost a laugh.
I heard rumours, but I dared not believe them.
Yes, indeed, after some trials. Nicolay tried to compose himself, but his throat had shrunk.
Do you live here now, then?
In Brickstad, I mean, not the cemetery.
No, no.
Still in the Silk Hall. But Asgard lives here now. I came to visit him. I thought I would visit Janart, too.
Of course.
There was a silence between them for a moment. Sit with me, Nicolay's, Aladine said with a brief smile, please. He considered the wisdom of following her, but did it anyway, to a stone bench by the cemetery wall. Aladine dusted the snow from it before she sat. He remembered how she had insisted on doing things the servants would usually manage, like polishing the marquetry and dusting the portraits Janart hung about the house. For a long while, the silence continued unbroken. Nicolay's watched the snowflakes falling. Years he had wondered what he would say if he ever saw Aladine again. Now the words eluded him.
Nicolay's, your arm.
His cloak had fallen back, revealing the stump.
Oh, yes, pirates, believe it or not, he said, forcing a smile.
I do believe it. People talk in this city. You already have a reputation as an adventurer. She smiled a little in return. It deepened the fine wrinkles around her eyes.
Nicolay's, I know we never spoke properly after Janart died. You left for Innis so quickly.
Don't. His voice was hoarse.
I know you must have realized all those years.
I don't seek to reprimand you, Nicolay's. Aladine spoke gently. I cared very deeply for Janart, but I had no claim on his heart. Our families arranged our marriage, as you know. It was not his choice. Snowflakes caught in her lashes. He was an extraordinary man. All I wanted for him was happiness. You were that happiness, Nicolay's, and I bear no grudge against you. In fact, I thank you.
Janart swore to give nobody else but you his favour. He swore it in sanctuary, before witnesses, Nicolay said tautly. You were always a pious woman, Ali.
I was, and am, she conceded. And that is why, though Janart broke that vow to me, I refused to break mine to him. I swore, first and foremost, to love and defend him. She laid a delicate hand over his. He needed your love. The best way I could honor the promises I made him was to let him have it in peace, and to let him love you in return. She meant it. The sincerity of her belief was carved deep into her face. Nicolay's tried to speak, but the words, whatever they were, stuck in his throat. He turned his hand and held hers in return.
Trude, he finally said. Where was she laid to rest?
The pain in her eyes was unbearable. Queen Sabran had her remains sent to me, she said. She lies in our family plot at Zeodur. Nicolay's tightened his grip on her hand. She missed you terribly, Nicolay's, she said. She was so very like Janart. I saw him in her smile, her hair, her cleverness. I wish you could have seen her as a woman. Something was pushing in his chest, making it hard to breathe. His jaw quaked with the effort of keeping it inside.
What will you do now, Nicolay's?
He swallowed the taste of grief.
Our young princess wants to offer me a place at court, he said, but I should sooner take up a professorship, not that anyone would give me one.
Ask her, Aladine said. I am sure the University of Brigstad would welcome you.
A former exile who dabbles in alchemy and spent weeks in the employ of pirates, he said dryly. Yes, that sounds like someone they would want to mold the minds of the next generation.
You have seen more of the world than others have written of it.
Imagine the insight you could bring, Nicolaes. You could shake the dust from the lecterns, breathe life into the textbooks.
The possibility warmed him. He had not given it serious consideration, but perhaps he would ask Amuna if she could intercede with the university on his behalf.
Aladine looked towards the mausoleum. Her breath shivered out in a white plume.
Nicolaes, she said, I understand if you would rather live your life here as a different man, but if you would favor me with your company from time to time.
Yes, he patted her hand. Of course I will, Aladine.
I'd be so glad. And of course, I could reintroduce you into society. You know, I have a very dear friend at the university, about our age, who I know would be delighted to meet you.
Alaric. He teaches astronomy.
Her eyes were sparkling. I am quite sure you would like him.
Well, he sounds...
And Asgard! Oh, Asgard will be overjoyed to see you again. And of course, you'd be welcome to stay with me for as long as you liked.
I certainly wouldn't wish to intrude, but...
Nicolaes, she said, you are family. You could never intrude.
You are very kind.
They looked at each other, slightly breathless from the outpouring of courtesy. Finally, Nicolaes managed a smile, and so did Aladine.
Now, she said, I hear you have an audience with our High Princess. Ought you not to get ready?
I ought to, Nicolaes admitted. But first, perhaps I could ask a small favor.
Of course.
I want you to tell me, in, he checked his pocket watch, 2 hours, everything that has happened since I left Ostender. I have years of politics and news to catch up on, and I don't want to look a fool in front of our new princess. Jamal was a historian, I know, he said lightly, but you were the one in the know when it came to gossip.
Aladine chuckled. I should be delighted, she said.
Come, we can walk by the Bugan, and you can tell me all about your adventure. Oh, dear lady, Nicolaes said, there is enough of a story there to fill a book.
Chapter 74 West. In Serin Hall, Lord Arteloff Beck worked in a study, a stack of letters and a leather-bound notebook beside him. His parents had gone away for a week, ostensibly for a change of scene, but Loth knew his mother was trying to prepare him for the future. To be Earl of Goldenbirch, with a seat on the Virtues Council, responsible for the largest province in Innis. He had hoped that as the years passed, something would shift in him, like clockwork into motion, and that he would be ready for it. Instead, he longed to be at court. One of his dearest friends was dead. As for Iad, he knew she would not stay in Innis forever. News that she had slain the Nameless One had spread, and she wanted none of the renown that would come with it. Sooner or later, her path would bend southward. Court would never be the same without the two of them, and yet it was where he thrived. It was where Ser Bran would rule for many years, and he wanted to be there with her, at the heart of their country, to help usher in a new and golden age for Innis.
Good evening.
Margaret walked into the study. I do think one should knock, Loth said, stifling a yawn.
I did, brother, several times.
She laid a hand on his shoulder.
Here, hot wine.
Thank you. He took a grateful sip. What time is it?
Past the time we both ought to have been asleep, Margaret rubbed her eyes. Strange to be on our own, without Mama and Papa. What have you been doing up here for hours?
Everything.
He felt her watching him as he closed the notebook. It was full of the household expenses.
You would sooner be at the palace, Margaret said, gently.
She knew him too well.
Loth only drank the wine, letting it warm the hollow in his belly.
I've always loved Serin Hall, and you have always loved court, and yet I was born the second child, and you the first, so you must be the Earl of Goldenbirch.
Margaret sighed. I suppose Mama thought you deserved a childhood away from Goldenbirch, since you would be rooted to it when you were older.
In fact, she made us both fall in love with the wrong place.
He had to smile at the absurdity of it. Well, nothing to be done about it.
I don't know. Innis is changing. Margaret said, a sparkle in her eye.
These next few years will be difficult, but they will give this country a new face. We should allow ourselves to broaden our horizons.
Loth looked up at her with a knitted brow. You do say the strangest things, sister.
The wisest are seldom appreciated in their time. She squeezed his shoulder before placing a letter in front of him. This arrived this morning. Try to get some sleep, brother. She left.
Loth turned over the letter and saw the wax seal. Impressed with the pair of the House of Vitalda. His heart clenched like a fist. He broke the seal and unfolded the letter inside, swirled with an elegant hand. As he read, a breeze rushed through the open window. It smelled of fresh-cut grass and hay and the life he had craved when he had been far from home. The scents of golden birch. Now something had changed. Other scents rushed like surf into his dreams. Salt and tar and cold sea wind. Mulled wine spiced with ginger and nutmeg. And lavender, the flower that had perfumed his dream of Iskallen. He picked up his quill and began to write. The fire burned low in the privy chamber at Briar House. Frost trimmed every window as if with lace. In the gloom, Sabran lay on her back on a settle, wine softened, looking as if she could fall asleep. Beside the hearth, long past the cusp of exhaustion, Ea drank her in. Sometimes, when she looked at Sabran, she almost believed she was the melancholy king, chasing a mirage across the dunes. Then Sabran would touch her lips to hers, or come to her bedside by moonlight, and she would know that it was real. "I have something to tell you," Sabran looked at her. "Sarsen came to me a few days ago," he had murmured, "with a letter from Chassar." The Sand Eagle had swept into Ascalon Palace, and onto her arm, carrying a note. It had taken Ead a long time to work up the courage to read it, and still longer to unravel her feelings when she did.
"Beloved, I have no words to express my pride in what we have heard of your deeds on the abyss, nor my relief that your heart beats as strong as it always has. When the prioress sent your sister to silence you, I could do nothing. Craven as I am, I failed you, as I promised Zala I never would. And yet, I am reminded, as I so often am, that you never needed my protection. You are your own shield. I write to you with long-awaited tidings. The Red Damsels wish you to return to Lassia to take up the mantle of the prioress. If you accept, I will meet you in Kumenga on the first day of winter. They could use your steady hand and level head. Most of all, they could use your heart. I hope you can forgive me. Either way, the orange tree awaits."
"Word that I was the slayer has spread," she said. "It is the greatest honor they could bestow." Slowly, Sabran sat up. "I am happy for you." She took Ead by the hand. "You slew the Nameless One, and this was your dream." Their gazes met. "Will you accept?"
"If I go," he had said, "I would be able to shape the future of the Priory." She interlocked their fingers. "Four of the High Westerns are dead. That means their wyverns and any progeny they sired have lost their fire. But even without it, they pose a danger to the world. They must be hunted and slain wherever they hide. And of course, a great enemy remains at large."
"Fyrdal," he had nodded.
"He must be hunted," she said. "But as prioress, I could also ensure the Red Damsels work to protect the stability of this new world. A world outside the shadow of the Nameless One."
Sabran poured them both another cup of perry. "You would be in Lassia," she said, her tone guarded.
"Yes."
The air between them was suddenly taut. Ead had never been naive enough to think that they could make a life together in Innis. As a Viscountess, she was fit to marry a queen, but she could not be a princess consort. She wanted no more titles or graces, no place beside the marble throne. Marriage to a queen required loyalty only to her realm, and Ead claimed no loyalty to anyone but the mother. Yet what was between them could not be denied. It was Sabran Berethnet who sang to her soul. "I would visit," he had said. "Not often, you understand. The prioress belongs in the south. But I would find a way." She took a cup. "I know I have said this to you once before, Sabran, but I would not blame you if you would prefer not to live that way."
"I would live alone for 50 years to have one day with you."
Ead unfolded herself and went to her. Sabran shifted up, and they sat with their legs intertwined. "I have something to tell you, too," Sabran said.
In a decade or so, I mean to abdicate the throne. I will use this period to ensure a smooth transition of power from the House of Berethnet to another ruler. Ead raised her eyebrows.
Your people believe in the divinity of your house, she said. How will you explain this to them?
I will say that now the Nameless One is dead, the age-old vow of the House of Berethnet to keep him at bay is fulfilled. And then I will honor the promise I made to Kagudo, she said. I will tell my people the truth, about Galleon, about Clearland. There will be a great reformation of Virtudom. A long breath escaped her. It will be very difficult. There will be years of denial, of anger, but it must be done. Ead saw the steel in her gaze.
So be it. She dropped her head onto Sabran's shoulder. But who will rule after you?
Sabran rested her cheek against Ead's brow. I think at first it must be one of the next generation of Duke Spiritual. The people will find it easier to embrace a new ruler from the nobility. But in truth, I do not think it well that the future of any country rests on the begetting of children. A woman is more than a womb to be seeded. Perhaps I can go further in this great reformation. Perhaps I can shake the very foundations of succession.
I believe you could, Ea traced her collarbone. You can be persuasive.
I suppose I inherited that gift from my ancestor. Ead knew now how Kaliba haunted her, Kaliba and the prophecy she had made. Often Sabran would wake in the night, remembering the witch whose face had been the mirror of hers. After she was healed, Ead had taken Kaliba's body to Nurtha. Finding someone who would row her to the island had been difficult. But eventually, when she had recognized Ead as Viscountess Nurtha, a young woman had scolded her across the little sea. The few people who lived on Nurtha spoke only Morgish and hung wreaths of hawthorn on their doors. None had spoken to her as she made her way through the woods. The hawthorn tree was felled, but not rotted. Ead could see that it had once been as magnificent as its sister in the south. She had stood among its branches and imagined a young Innish girl plucking a red berry from its branches, a berry that had changed her forever. She had laid the Witch of Iniska to rest beneath it. The only first blood that now remained was what lived in Sabran and in Tane. For a time, only the snap of the fire broke the silence. Finally, Sabran moved to sit on the footstool in front of Ead so they could face each other and laced their fingers.
Don't laugh at me. Are you about to say something foolish?
Possibly. Sabran paused as if to collect herself.
In the days before Virtudom, the people of Iniska would make a troth plight to the one they loved. A promise that they would make a home together. She held her gaze. You must do your duty as prioress. I must do mine as Queen of Innis. For a time, we must go our separate ways. But 10 years from now, I will meet you on the sand of Perchling, and we will find our somewhere.
He had looked down at their joined hands. 10 years without being with her each day. 10 years of separation. The thought hollowed her. But she knew how to ache for something far away. She knew how to endure. Sabran watched her face. At last, Ead leaned close and kissed her. 10 years, she said, and not one sunrise more.
Chapter 75 East. The Imperial Palace was much the same as it had been the last time Lady Tane of Clan Medushi had set foot in its halls. As the sun went down, she walked away from the Hall of the Fallen Star, past servants clearing paths with shovels, blowing warmth into her hands. While she regained her strength in preparation for her formal return to the High Sea God, she had acted as an unofficial ambassador between Psyche and the Empire of the 12 Lakes. The unceasing Emperor had been courteous, as always. He had given her a letter to take back to Ginnura, as he often did, and they had spoken for a time about what was happening on the other continents. All seemed quiet in the world, yet Tane was restless. Something called to her from a distant past. Nyarlathotep waited in the grand courtyard, surrounded by well-dressed lacustrine courtiers who carefully touched her scales for a blessing. Tane climbed into the saddle and pulled on her gauntlets.
"Do you have the letter?" the dragon asked.
"Yes," Tane patted her neck. "Are you ready, Nyarlathotep?"
"Always."
She took to the sky, and soon enough they were over the Sundance Sea. Pirates still roamed its waters. Although discussions with Innis were underway,
the Red Sickness was not yet abated, and for now the Great Edict stood, as Tane suspected it would for some time. The Golden Empress was out there somewhere. She would live for as long as the Seaband did, and while she drew breath, the trade in dragonflesh would endure. Tane meant to make good on the vow she had made to her on Komaridu, in the shadow of the mulberry tree. Once she had recovered from her injuries, she had begun the climb back to strength with Onred and Demusa. Soon, she would be ready to return to the waves. The Warlord of Psyche had rewarded her for her actions on the Abyss. She had been given a mansion in Nanta and her life back. Except Susa. That loss would remain an arrowhead in her, buried too deep to dig out. Each day, she expected another water ghost to come out of the sea, a ghost without its head. Nyarlathotep returned her to Ginnura, where she delivered the letter and returned to Saltflower Castle. As she combed her hair, she cast her gaze towards the bronze mirror and traced a scar on her cheekbone, the scar that had set her on the path to the Abyss. She changed out of her travel-soiled clothes and slung on her cloak. At dusk, she walked to Ginnura Bay, where Nyarlathotep was bathing on the same beach where she had been captured. Tane walked into the shallows. "Nyarlathotep," she said, placing a hand on her scales, "I would like to go now, if you will take me." That wild gaze locked on hers. "Yes," the dragon said, "to Komaridu." Not long before, Tane had returned to the village of Ampiki, her first visit since she was a child, to search for any trace of Nipuro of Komaridu. It had never been rebuilt after the fire. The only people there had been the young men and women who collected seaweed from its shore. She had gone back to Feather Island to speak to Elder Vara, who had welcomed her with open arms. He had told her all he knew about Nipuro, though it was precious little. There were records of her marriage to a painter, several more letters that pertained to the rise of a new ruler in the east, and some fanciful drawings of what the Queen of Komaridu might have looked like. In the end, there was only one place to find her. Light pulsed through Nyarlathotep as she flew. When Komaridu came into sight, a drop of ink on the face of the sea, she descended onto its sand, and Tane slid out of the saddle. "I'll wait here," Nyarlathotep said. Tane patted her in return. She lit her lantern and walked into the trees. This was her inheritance. The island for outcasts. One fateful day, as a child in Ampiki, Tane had followed a butterfly to the sea. Elder Vara had told her that in some tales, butterflies were the spirits of the dead, sent by the Great Quirrici. Like dragons, they changed their shape, and so the Great Quirrici, in his wisdom, had chosen them as his messengers from the celestial plane. If not for that butterfly, Tane would have perished with her parents, and the jewel might have been lost. Hours she walked the silent forest. Here and there, she found glimpses of what must once have stood 1,000 years before. Foundations of houses long since fallen. Shards of cord-marked pottery. The blade of an axe. She wondered if, beneath the ground, the soil was packed with bones. Unsure of what she was looking for, or why, she walked until she found a cave. Inside was a statue of a woman, whittled into the rock, her face weathered, but whole. Tane knew that face. It was her own. She set the lantern down and knelt before the first blood. In her mind, she had thought of all the things she had wanted to say to her, but now she was here, she had only one. "Thank you." Nipuro gazed back at her, unblinking. Tane watched her, feeling as if she were in a dream. She stayed until the lantern had burned out. In the darkness, she took the stairs she had taken once before, up to the ripped-up mulberry tree that had died beneath the stars. Tane lay beside it and fell asleep. In the morning, a white butterfly was cupped in her hand, and her side was damp with blood. Chapter 76. West. The Rose Eternal skirted the western coast of Iskallen. Since Fyrdal had disappeared, its people had begun to rebuild the damage wrought in the draconic years. Prayer houses and sanctuaries rose from the wreckage. Lavender was planted in the fields that had been burned, and soon enough, red pear trees would sweeten the streets of Cascaro again. Meerswine leaped together from the waves, spraying water. Dusk had fallen, but Iad had never felt more awake. The salt wind danced through her hair,
and she breathed it deep into her lungs.
Prioress, she who stood where the mother once had, guardian of the orange tree. All her life she had been a handmaiden. She had never known what it was to rule. She had also spent enough time with Sabran to know that a crown was a heavy weight to bear, but the Priory of the Orange Tree did not possess a crown. She was not an empress or a queen, but one cloak among many. She would find out where Fyrdal had hidden, and she would slay him as she had his master. She would not rest until the only fire that ascended came through the orange tree and the mages who ate of its fruit. And when the long-haired star came once more, the balance would be restored. Gian Harlow came to join her at the stern, clay pipe in hand. He lit it with a taper, breathed in deeply, and puffed out a wreath of blue-tinged smoke. He had watched it drift away.
"Queen Marosa will invite the foreign sovereigns to her court in the spring, I hear," he said, "to open Iskallen again."
He had nodded. "Let us hope that this peace holds."
"Aye."
For a time, the only sound was the waves.
"Captain," he had said, and Harlow grunted. "At the Innish court, there are rumours about you, spoken deep in the shadows. Rumours that you courted Queen Rosarian." She watched his brow darken. "They say you meant to take her to the Milk Lagoon."
"The Milk Lagoon is a fable," he said curtly. "A tale whispered to children and lovers without hope."
"A wise young woman told me once that our legends grow from seeds of truth."
"Is it you or the Queen of Innis who desires the truth?"
He had waited, watching his face. Those eyes were in a distant past.
"She was never much like Rose," his voice softened. "She was nightborn, you know. They say that makes a child grave. But Rose came into the world at the lark's calling." He drew on his pipe again. "Some truths," he said, "are safest buried. Some castles best kept in the sky. There's promise in tales that are yet to be spoken. In the shadow realm, known only to the few."
He glanced at her.
"You ought to know, Eadaz Uknara, you whose secrets will one day be a song."
With the faintest smile, Ead cast her gaze towards the stars.
"One day, perhaps," she said, "but not today."
This has been an Audible Studios production of The Priory of the Orange Tree, written by Samantha Shannon, performed by Leah Summers. Copyright by Samantha Shannon Jones, 2019. Production copyright 2019 by Audible Limited. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Limited.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this programme.